So, just got a couple of questions about this, so just to make sure we're all on the same page. The EEA refers to, at least in our case, a period in human evolution up to roughly 8 to 10,000 years ago. Really, I mean, the specific years are a bit vague. It's really dealing with the concept of when did humans go from living and existing and behaving the way that they have for a really long time up to something a little bit different. So when did they really start shifting out of a predominantly hunter-gatherer existence? Now keep in mind, there are still hunter-gatherer groups around in the world. Not very many of them, and they live in pretty crappy environments because everyone who stopped being a hunter-gatherer pretty got better technology and pushed all the hunter-gatherers into the shite zones of the world. So that's kind of a tough break on them, but they still do exist. So, I mean, you might argue, you know, somehow these hunter-gatherers have not actually left the EEA. I mean, it's, you know, what we're talking about here is sort of the majority of people. Okay, so just, I guess we could talk about EEAs for different species, right? I mean, what's the EEA of cows? That would probably be back before they were domesticated cows. So they're wild cows. I'm having a hard time visualizing that, actually. You know, great herds of Jersey cows thundering across the... So back when they were like ox or something like that, okay. So, I mean, maybe we could talk about this with other species, but it's all pretty artificial to do it that way. So it's really dealing with humans here. Okay, so last class, we'd finished up talking about the IGF-2 gene. And as well, just to sort of... I had somebody ask me about this afterwards. So you got to remember, it depends on the parent that it comes in from. So the female could have an IGF-2, an active IGF-2 allele in the egg. But if that's the only one that goes into the offspring, it's not going to do anything. So if the female's got an active IGF-2, comes into the egg, it's going to be neutral. The male has an active IGF-2 that comes with the sperm, then it's going to be active in the offspring. Okay? Conversely, if you've got the false receptor imprinted gene, the male could have an active version of that allelic form in the sperm, comes in, it'll do nothing. In the case of the female, if it's there in the egg, then it comes in, then it does something. So you could also have, you might say, well, wait a minute, what if the female's got the false receptor imprint gene that comes into the egg, but there's no IGF-2 active form coming into the sperm? Well, then it just stays neutral. Then that false receptor doesn't do anything. There's no additional insulin-like growth factor to gobble up, so it's just a neutral. It's a neutral gene. It's a sleeper, if you will. It's a sleeper allele, which can get passed on down through the generations. Okay. I saw somebody say, "Well, wait a minute, but if you've got the false receptor, isn't that going to make the baby really, really small?" It's like, no, this is only dealing with, the false receptor is only dealing with sucking up the additional IGF-2 produced insulin-like growth factor coming from the IGF-2 gene. There's lots of other growth factors. I mean, that's the normal sort of part of human development. Different genes mean you have a little bit more, a little bit less, different environmental parameters, a little bit more, a little bit less. This is talking about just a little bit more. This is kind of like, you know, watch the mockumentary, This Is Spinal Tap. We've got the bit with the, no, you're not old, I guess, like me, but the scene in there where the fake band, and they've got these speaker systems, and, you know, someone goes up to 11 speakers, usually the dial goes up to 10. It's like, yeah, well, you know, if we need just a little bit more sound, we turn it up to 11. It's like, why don't you just make it go from 1 to 10 and have 10 be the most? No, this one goes to 11. So, okay. This is like going to 11. Okay, it's just that little bit of additional growth factor. Okay. Right, DNA. I mean, hopefully review. Deoxyribonucleic acid, good old friend, the double helix, made up nucleotide. Nucleotide's got a backbone component to it, and the base pairs, adenine, thymine, go together, cytosine, guanine, go together. You got to remember here again, the amino acids are just going to be coded for by triplet base pairs. So three base pairs together make a triplet. Those code each for a particular amino acid, 22 amino acids, and then some start and stop codons that are produced. But there's going to be duplications there, like we said last class. Ultimately, these amino acids go together, taken off through RNA, off out into the cell to produce proteins. So this is where we're eventually going with all of this, is a gene, which is a long collection of codons, is just making proteins. That's really all it does. So as we said last class, it's a bit of a shorthand to talk about genes for some behavior or some physical trait, when really what we should be talking about is genes coding for a particular protein. But honestly, that gets really tedious, and it's a lot easier to talk about them in terms of the characteristics or traits that they influence. So, all told, your DNA makes up your genome. It used to be said that your genome or your DNA was like a blueprint. It's not a particularly good metaphor. First off, your DNA is not actually blue, so that kind of breaks down right there. Second, a blueprint is how something is supposed to be really done precisely. And if it isn't done precisely, you probably can't build the structure. So a better metaphor is perhaps that of a recipe. You've got a recipe for muffins, you can substitute things. Ooh, I don't have baking powder. Well, that's okay. I can use baking soda. I can use baking soda, about twice as much baking soda, and a bit of lemon juice to activate, and you'll get much the same effect. In the same way, this often happens with the DNA. You get a slight mutation that changes a protein structure in a very small way. It may have no actual consequence. However, here's another sort of metaphor that I kind of like. It's the concept of the genome as a book. So if you will, there are 23 chapters in this book that is you, actually. You are the book. And each of these chapters is called a chromosome. Each chapter contains several thousand stories, each one called a gene. Each story is made up of paragraphs called exons, which are unfortunately interrupted with advertisements called introns. Each paragraph is made up of words called the codons, and each word is written by letters called the bases. This becomes slightly more complicated when we get into the introns. The old idea was that introns were junk DNA, just trash that was left over from our ancestral past and got isolated and tucked away and not used anymore. This isn't quite true. There's actually a lot of very interesting research being done showing that there's actually some very important things that happen in the introns, not all of which we entirely understand. There's some things that are called pseudogenes, for example, or sometimes in the introns there are activation zones which may increase or decrease the transcription of particular other genes or parts of genes. So there's a lot of interesting things going on there. But I guess like advertisements, sometimes an advertisement may tell you something with respect to the story. Not always, but occasionally. So there we have it. All right. As I've said already, what do genes really do? Well, all they're doing is producing amino acids which get strung together to form polypeptide protein production. So that's really it. We then can link these polypeptides together in various ways. So we can make some proteins are rather small, some are gigantic. Well, relatively speaking, I mean, still part of you, so fairly small, but still, from the point of view of molecules, some of these are stunningly large. They've got a very complex folding pattern. Just to step out of this and into, say, perceptual and cognitive psychology, people have been trying for years to work up computer programs to analyze and predict the way that the underlying protein structure would fold into three-dimensional shapes. As it turns out, some cognitive psychologists have recently found that people do actually a better job of figuring out how a protein folds together than a computer does. They essentially give people a protein, either as a physical model or like a string of things that get bent in various ways, or on a computer screen they can manipulate, and give it to them as a puzzle. And our brains are actually very good at doing that sort of thing. We can actually come up with ways that these proteins can fold together into three-dimensional space better than computer programs that are dedicated to trying to figure this out can do. So, yay brain, good for us. All right. Now, as I said, once we've got these proteins, how that actually turns into a behavioral trait is going to depend very much on a lot of environmental parameters. Okay, so again, technically, this is why we should really talk about genes coding for proteins, you know, as opposed to saying, well, you've got the gene for eye color or height or melanin content or aggression or whatever, because it's not a one-to-one correlation between a protein and a behavior. There's always that environment there that is going to influence things. Raise organisms in a restricted environment, and you will get very different behaviors. Slap some little goggles onto kittens, where the goggles have little horizontal stripes on them. Make the kittens wear these goggles for the first, oh, say, 8 to 10 weeks of their development, and you will have cats that cannot see anything in the vertical. Great at seeing things horizontally, but they can't see anything vertically. Does that mean they lack the genes involved in vertical vision? No. They were just in a deprived environment. Without being exposed to any sort of vertical visual arrays, the environment was deprived. The part of their nervous system that was developing, that part of the optic cortex, didn't develop properly. Consequently, they can't see in the vertical. Okay. So this is, they probably had the genes for it. They just had a deprived environment. Case of the Romanian orphanages, where kids weren't denied basic physical requirements, necessities, food, water, sanitation, these things, but they didn't really have much in the way of human contact. So this came into the press back in the 1990s, the fall of communist government in Romania. Found all these state orphanages with thousands and thousands of children who had basically just been left in cribs with practically no adult interaction. So their language skills are stunningly perturbed. Many of them are essentially autistic in this sense because they lack that interaction. So they didn't. You need that interaction. We are predisposed to acquire language, but we have to be exposed to it. Without that environmental stimulation, our language centers do not develop well. Even if you subsequently find a child that has been linguistically deprived, perhaps given no exposure to language, after about age 7 or 8, you will never get them back to sort of native speaking abilities there. They will always have some form of a deficit. So there is a critical period of development. The genes are there. They should be able to do this fine, but with an environmental different environment, this is going to change things. We'll talk later about things like, say, what are called the diathesis stress model in terms of things like schizophrenia. We'll also talk about this in terms of things like psychopaths and how psychopathy may actually be an adaptation under certain environmental conditions. You may need a particular genome, particular genes that could allow you to become psychopathic, but under situations of enriched environments with access to resources, good socialization, these genes don't activate. But under cases of deprivation, dangerous environment, unstable resources, becoming a psychopath may be very adaptive. Think back, we've talked about what's the level of evolutionary selection. Well, it's on the individual. The thing with psychopaths are that they don't really care about anybody else. They probably actually can't, but they're very good at faking it. So who benefits? Well, the psychopath. And again, if you think about this from sort of an extreme form of selection on the individual, it's great for the individual psychopath until they get caught. And just to kind of keep you up at night, our best estimates are we only catch about half of them. Oh, but don't worry. Most of them aren't going to try to eat you. They'll just try to sell you a crappy car or embezzle money from you or just kind of mess with you for amusement value. Okay. We'll talk about psychopaths later. Okay. I've been talking about sort of macro-environmental things, even down at the level of the cell, right? How much sugar is actually in the cytoplasm of the cell can influence the way that the protein actually forms, the way it actually folds up into the polypeptide. And that can influence, actually it's the same protein, but it's folded in a slightly different way. that's going to influence its ability to do whatever job is needed by the cells. So again, these are very complicated, complicated things. There are roughly 30,000 genes in the human genome. Back in 2001, the initial release of the Human Genome Project data came out. This is a bit of a surprise. It was generally assumed, going back in the 1990s, well, and earlier as well, but pretty much up until the release of this information, that we must have had at least something like 60,000 to 70,000 genes, because we're pretty complicated, so this should require lots and lots of genes, right? Bit of a surprise for us. It's like, only 30,000. Well, the point is, these genes can do lots of different things. Now, what the Human Genome Project did was actually just managed to map the loci of the genes on all the chromosomes. We don't actually know what they all do. So we don't actually know what all 30,000 of these genes do, even in terms of what proteins do they produce. We also have really no clue as to how all of them are going to interact. We know how some of them interact, but there's a lot of other ones out there that we don't know how they may interact with one another. We also know much less about how the environment or how different environmental effects can influence the genes. So there's still a huge amount to be figured out about this. So back in, you may or may not remember this, but back in the early 2000s, there was a lot of people that had this sort of fear, doom and gloom. It's like, oh, we've got the Human Genome Project, now we're going to be back to total eugenics. People are going to actually start customizing their children. They're going to be making some sort of ubermensch, the ultimate race of super people that will all be whatever. It's like, really? That requires us to actually understand everything. I think we're a long ways from that, you know? Even into the future, we're a long ways from that. It's like, right, yes, you want blonde, you want 6 foot tall, you want blue eyes. We can do that, but he's going to be a Flames fan. Sorry. No! Okay. I really want the Oilers. Well, okay, in that case, it's going to be about 5'8". No, see, we can't do this yet. So, I mean, the kind of concerns that get into the public and the kind of scaremongering about evolution and genetics here is really somewhat misplaced. All right. Now, just a reminder, heritability, the degree to which phenotypic variance in the population is going to be due to genotypic variance. So we're really looking here, when we talk about heritability, now again, remember, heritability is dealing with populations. It's not dealing with an individual. So it makes no point to talk about your heritability, right? You have the traits that you have. Your genome accounts for what you have. The phenotype is what it is for you, your genome interacting with the environment. So when we talk about heritability, we're actually talking about populations, the degree of variation in some phenotypic characteristic. And because both genes and environment can contribute, then this becomes a useful sort of term. But it doesn't deal with individuals. This is something else the popular press often gets wrong. It's a little bit confusing because we talk about things that are heritable traits and things that are inherited. So a heritable trait is one that has a high genetic component to it. The genome is strongly involved in producing this trait. The environment has less effect. Then we talk about things like inherited. So you can actually have highly heritable traits that are not inherited. Okay, because for whatever reason, the particular allele doesn't get passed into the offspring. Or, in many cases, for example, autism. Autism is a highly heritable trait that tends not to be inherited. Why? Because most autistics do not have children. You have to get into the high-functioning autistics before they may actually care enough about other people to try to find a mate. So this doesn't tend to happen. So, you know, just one example. I'm not saying autistics can't have children. They can. But it tends not to be inherited. So these are a few terms. Just keep these a little bit in mind here. But generally, when we talk about heritability, the greater the heritability and the higher the value, the greater the genetic control over that trait. So the less environmental influence is there. And for most of the kinds of behaviors that psychologists are interested in, heritability scores range from maybe 0.2 up to maybe 0.7. 0.7 would be really high. That's a lot of heritable control. That's a lot of genetic regulation there. More commonly, things in the range of, say, 0.35 up to maybe 0.5. So there's still a huge amount of environmental influence on many of these behaviors. Even in cases where we have relatively high heritable traits, the environment can still play a role. So I mentioned psychopathy. Once it's activated, once someone becomes psychopathic, once they are psychopath, you really can't change them. I mean, it's tough. You've pretty much got to deal with this in terms of making it in their own best interests to behave in a more socially acceptable way. Or find them some sort of job they can do where they're allowed to be righteous bastards with respect to the rest of the population. Like, oh, prosecuting attorneys or, oh, I don't know, Donald Trump. Not that I'm implying that Donald Trump is a psychopath, but one does wonder. So the environment can still play a large role in this. Schizophrenia, a highly heritable characteristic, but we'll talk about what's called the diathesis stress model. You've got identical twins, say two identical twins, one schizophrenic, the other isn't. Genetically, they're the same. So the environment can still play a role. Some particular stressor activates the schizophrenia in one gene, in one twin, but not in the other. Which stressor? We don't know. Why in this twin and not that twin? Hard to say. How much of a stress? Again, hard to say. Something like schizophrenia is interesting. Totally different course here. A little bit off topic here. But, I mean, schizophrenia, we just say, oh, schizophrenia, there, it's a disease. Well, it's probably a whole bunch of diseases. Lots and lots of different ways to be schizophrenic. Even people that have the same phenotypic characteristics often respond very differently to drug treatments. So we're probably dealing not with one or even a few subsets of a disease, but with lots of things. And again, that's why perhaps different environments can lead to differential activation of the genes. When we do talk about, say, sources of control here, we often talk about this in terms of correlations. So if you remember, your correlations can run from 0 to 1, either in positive or negative. Okay? So if you do well in your midterm and you do well in your final, there's a positive correlation. If you do well in the midterm but poorly on the final, we've got a negative correlation. Or conversely, poorly on the midterm and well in the final, we've got a negative correlation. Okay? Generally, the closer we get to one, the stronger correlation is there. And as I said, in behaviors that we're interested in, typically in psychology, maybe from the range of 0.3 to 0.7, with most of the characteristics we describe as high heritable behaviors or high heritable personality characteristics, really only in the range of 0.5 to 0.7. So again, lots of environmental influence there. Now, when we look at things in terms of the variation, we said, we look around, you're all a bit different. Okay? Why? Why is variation a useful thing? We tend to see this in sexually reproducing species. Variation between individuals is high. Matter of fact, as I think I was saying last class, those species that tend to lose this variation in individuals, they're probably heading towards extinction. Might take a while, but that's probably where they're going. Let's think about this from the perspective of an individual having a bunch of offspring. Okay? At the proximate level, why is there variation in the offspring? Well, sexual reproduction, every time you have a new offspring, you're mixing up, it's a random distribution, mostly, genes from mom and genes from dad, or, pardon me, not the genes, but the allelic forms of the genes from mom and the allelic forms of the genes from dad, put them together, what do you got? You got a new kid. So, because of chromosomal and gene mutations, there's going to be huge amounts of variation there. So the actual creation of an embryo at that sort of immediate cause-effect level here, proximate level, everyone's going to be a little bit different, barring things like identical twins. Okay? Barring a fertilized ovum, which rips apart and produces now two or more triplets, quads, whatnot. If we look at it from a different level, let's skip over the ontogenetic and phylogenetic, and let's drop right down to the ultimate level here. From the ultimate level here, we've said environments will change. But if you've got a change occurring in the environment, let's say you've got the parents that are really well adapted to the environment. Now, if the parents just clone themselves, so made identical copies of the parents to pass into the next generation, if the environment shifted such that now the parents were in real trouble, the parents are no longer well adapted to the environment, none of their offspring are going to be well adapted to the environment. Matter of fact, if the new environment is going to kill the parents, odds are it's going to kill all of their offspring. Now, we said in terms of differential reproductive success, that's measured by how many of your offspring actually survive to reproduce themselves. Oops. However, if you don't clone yourselves, if you put variation into your offspring, so let's imagine we've got an organism that has 10 offspring. Okay, they're all a little bit different from one another. Well, the environment changes. Parent dies, can't cope with the new environment. Now, odds are, some of these offspring, before the environment had changed, so before there was a shift in environment, were going to be a little bit more like the parent, therefore well adapted to the environment. Some would be less adaptive and may have been heading for death. The environment changes. The parent dies because it can't cope with the environment. Those offspring that were perhaps most similar to the parent may also die or perhaps suffer to some degree. And perhaps those offspring that were not well adapted before the environmental change become adapted. Maybe they do well. So it's kind of hedging your bets. By having variation in there, by putting that change into your offspring, by giving the possibility for environmental change, building this into our reproduction, you're saying, well, it's kind of like insurance. If things shift, perhaps at least some of my offspring will survive to carry on at least some of my genetic material. We see this in a number of species, things like Daphnia, for example, sometimes called water fleas. You can see them with your naked eye, but it's hard. A magnifying glass or a microscope makes this a lot easier. Tiny little multicellular animals live in ponds and large puddles and sloughs and all over Alberta, all over the world, really. Through most of the season, so they overwinter as incipient eggs. They boom, hatch out in the spring. From spring until, sort of late spring until late summer, let's say. Early spring to late summer. They reproduce asexually. They just clone themselves, essentially. Late summer, though, they start producing males. Not all. Some males are produced. And they switch to sexual reproduction. And sort of the last few generations before, the generations are very short on these things, right? Measured in kind of a week, sort of, here. The last few generations before the ponds freeze over, before winter hits, before they lay the last batch of eggs and let them overwinter, are being produced through sexual reproduction. Now, why? Why is this adaptive for Daphnia to be asexually for most of the years and then switch to sexual reproduction at the end? Any thoughts? How much snow do we have this last winter? More or less than the few years before? Probably more. What do you think that did to water levels in ponds and sloughs and things this spring? Probably a lot higher. Last year, the water levels were lower. So if the Daphnia that were doing well in previous years were Daphnia that were well adapted to low levels of water, which would mean probably water's going to heat up more, you're going to have hotter ponds, okay? If they'd simply cloned themselves last fall. And then we've got a whole generation of all hot water, shallow slough, shallow pond Daphnia, and we have much more early spring runoff, more flooding, deeper sloughs, deeper ponds, water's going to be cooler. Boom. You got a whole bunch of poorly adapted Daphnia that may not actually make it through. They may all die. So because you can't predict the future, this is the same thing we talked about in terms of eugenics. You can't predict the future. That's why there's a problem with eugenics. Eugenics operates on, we're going to make us adapted for what we know now. That's essentially an asexual reproduction technique. So a eugenics movement would like to move us out of being sexually reproducing species that put variation. We've evolved the ability to put variation into our species. They want to take that out. Make us more like bacteria. Only works well if we've got a very, very quick reproductive cycle. Yeah. Right. Why towards the very end? Because things are relatively stable, usually. You can obviously get the odd year where things aren't. Suddenly the weather changes, shifts, and whatnot, and that just kind of sucks for the Daphnia. They can actually switch to... I wasn't quite clear. They can actually... It's a good question. They can actually switch into sexual reproduction if there's a sudden change in environment. It's the environmental triggers that will activate when they shift into sexual reproduction. So if you've got some sort of extreme weather situation that comes really early or something, they can switch into that. But something has to really perturb them out of a sort of normal spring through summer kind of range of things there. So yeah, it's a good point. They can do this. But usually you don't get anything too bizarre during a season. It's the seasonal changes where things can really get messed up. You don't know what's coming the next year. So in that case there, they actually have evolved to, if you got a winning system, stick with the winning system until you have to mix it up. Okay? Like baseball analogies, and who doesn't, right? Or hockey. If you've got a winning line, if you've got a winning team, why trade your players away? Why try to bring somebody else into your starting line? But if it's not doing well, then you need to go looking for a new draft choice. I'm not sure I'm doing any service to evolution by dropping into things like hockey kind of metaphors here. I don't know. Okay. Another big thing here, and we're going to talk about this more in a while, is the issue of disease and parasitism. Most parasites have very, very short reproductive cycles, short generations. As such, if a disease gets into the population, everyone's more or less the same, everyone's going to get it. If it's really effective disease, you're all going to die. If there's variation in the population, not everybody is going to be infected. Or if they are infected, they may not at least be killed. So, I mean, classic example, Typhoid Mary. Woman who could carry typhoid, but it wouldn't kill her. Spread it all over. HIV. There are people that will probably live out their natural life being HIV infected without actually moving on to AIDS. They never progress that far. Pretty much a given. I mean, again, back into the 80s, HIV, AIDS, it's going to eliminate, it's going to be the end of humanity. It's like, no, most parasites don't work that way unless you genetically engineer them to do that, which is... military type approaches to things. If parasites kill all their hosts, well, that's pretty much game over for the parasites as well. But the fact is, there's variation. Not everyone is going to be susceptible to a disease to the same degree. We'll talk about that more in a little while. Okay. Evolution is generational. So we've talked about this a little bit here, briefly back to the historical section on Lamarck versus Darwinian approaches here. If we take a look at, for example, when we probably diverged from when our ancestors, when we got that bifurcation in terms of what headed off ultimately to become chimpanzees and what went off eventually to become Homo sapiens. There's been probably 5 million, 6 million years, something like that. That's roughly maybe ballpark here, you know, ballpark, 300,000 generations. 5 million years, 300,000 generations. Now, if you take a look at something like bacteria, in 25 years, bacteria will go through 300,000 generations. Took our ancestors probably about 5 million, give or take. Who's evolving faster? Well, the bacteria, actually, if you measure it by generations, bacteria is evolving much more rapidly. If you measure it by degree of variation in the genome in each generation, being non-sexual reproducers, mostly, I know, there's ways that bacteria can essentially act like they're sexual reproducing, but most of them generally operate asexually, then this becomes more complicated. So it's a little bit of a shell game here to try to talk about who's out-evolving. You know, what species is winning the evolution game here? Because really, the evolution game is tied into the environment. But at least what we can say here is if the environment shifts, bacteria are going to be able to adapt to that environment more rapidly than we are. Just in the case of, you know, people are talking about how much effect global warming could have in 25 years. Well, that's a generation and a bit for humans. 300,000 generations for bacteria. From their point of view, they'll be able to just keep adapting along as they go. Environments can change quite rapidly. Now, again, this becomes an issue of time scale. What are we talking about here? Very often we get, from our point of view, we can get short-term shifts. Hey, you notice we just went through a pretty big environmental change over the last month. We went from winter into spring. That's huge. But, over a longer period, that happens every year. So it's not that big of a deal from our point of view. Our lifespans are so large that we just see these things come and go. They're little short-term bubbles. Long-term effects are going to be effects of global warming, oncoming ice ages, all kinds of things like that. Okay. From bacteria's point of view, switching from spring to summer, that's actually a pretty big environmental shift. Because in the course of that month, thousands of bacteria are going to live and die. You may have dozens of generations, probably hundreds of generations that you're going to go through. So from their point of view, it sucks. But from their point of view, it's gradual. Going from winter into spring, huge change there, right? From minus 20 to plus 20. Yeah, but given the bacteria only lasting a week or sort of thing there, we're not seeing as big of a temperature gradient shift. You get the idea. Under certain circumstances, conditions, gene frequencies can actually change. I don't want to say really quickly, but let's at least say moderately quickly. Okay? And again, this is one of these things that was not generally accepted going back even 20 years ago. So we've got the Santa Barbara School that comes up with things have been more or less, not a lot has changed over the last 10,000 years. Because it takes so long to do this, it's like, well, actually, it looks like about 7% of our genome, a lot of it dealing with our nervous system and immune system, has been under some pretty significant environmental pressures over the last 10 to 40,000 years. So depending what's happening, certain things can shift rather rapidly. Other things may be somewhat slower. In the cases of not just humans, but especially humans, our combination of variability in the population and the fact that our population is so incredibly large at this point, more people than ever before, and our ability to learn and thereby modify our environment through cognitive understanding of things allows us to actually adapt to change in a much more rapid way than just ancestral evolution alone. Process. There's a lot of things actually that happen in terms of evolution that don't involve natural selection at all. So sometimes, again, generally lay public, or sometimes, unfortunately, even high school textbooks come out and say, you know, evolution is natural selection. Well, and sexual selection, but we may not want to talk about sex in high school. So, right, okay, you know, but natural selection. Evolution is natural selection. There's a bunch of evolutionary processes that don't involve natural selection. Oh, remember, natural selection, characteristics that confer a selective advantage, survival advantage on the individual, are more likely to be passed on. Well, there's other stuff as well. Gene flow, for example. If you just have an animal or group of animals that moves from one population to another, if these populations have been somewhat isolated, imagine you've got two populations of chickadees on either side of a mountain range. They've been isolated for many generations. They're both still chickadees, but they're not interbreeding with one another because they're isolated by a mountain range. If you have, I don't know, typhoon, hurricane, big gusty winds, whoosh, some chickadees get blown into the new population. Or a bunch of people decide to trap chickadees from one side of the mountain range because they like how they sing and take them with them as they migrate to the other side of the mountain range and release them. Okay, that stuff has actually happened, okay? People have actually done this, right? We're going to take these animals with us and introduce them. Gene flow. Suddenly, a whole bunch of new genes that hadn't been there before, boop, come into the population. They didn't show up through natural or sexual selection processes. They're just suddenly there. Now, if this new batch of genes that comes in have advantages, then they're going to spread more rapidly through this now mixed population. Okay, so it's not due to natural selection leading to that change in the gene frequencies in our population on the whatever the west side of the mountain range. It's due to gene flow. Genetic drift. Changes occur in populations due to chance, not because these characteristics were either selected for or against. So you might have just some neutral. Could be, for example, neutral characteristics. Things just neutral characteristics are neutral. Well, we'll come back and talk about Pitcairn Island in a moment here. Some characteristic that isn't being selected for one way or another, it just builds up in the population. Density of hair on the scalp. Probably fairly neutral characteristic. Brunettes tend to have coarser hairs, fewer hairs on their heads. Blondes tend to have finer hair, more actual hairs in the head. Does it confer any actual advantage? Probably not. At least no one's come up with a particularly good explanation for how it would. Okay, but we have populations that are more brunette or more blonde. So in that case, the hair density probably is not something that's being selected for. It's just drifted along. Founder effect. I should say genetic drift usually affects only small populations initially here. Founder effect is seen as a subset of genetic drift, and it's perhaps a good way of sort of conceptualizing this if you ever encountered the concept before. Classic example that biology texts love to talk about is a pregnant rodent is on a tree on the edge of a river. The river is swollen with floodwaters. The tree breaks away from the bank, drops into the river, taking the pregnant female rodent, rat, you know, whatever you like, right, with her. She's washed out to sea. After many weeks, her tree washes up on an island. Fortunately, there is fruit on the tree, so she's able to survive. Okay, there are no other, fill in blank, of rodent on this island. She gives birth to her young, and they populate the entire island. There we go. So here we've got what's called a founder effect. A very small number of genes coming from perhaps a pregnant female or a small group of, very small group of animals, ends up in an isolated location, populates the entire island. Obviously, we're going to get some inbreeding effects going on here as well, which will probably just exacerbate the situation. So we will have probably a very different genetic set of characteristics, traits in this little hypothetical island situation. Human example, Pitcairn Island. I'm going to take you back to the 1780s when the idea was to send Captain Bligh with the good ship Bounty off to Tahiti to dig up breadfruit trees. Breadfruit trees produced breadfruit. Really? So, did anyone have breadfruit? No? No? It's kind of a gourdy type thing, which nowadays, if you ever get to go to the Polynesian Islands or even Caribbean, is most typically treated like a giant potato and chopped up and fried and dipped in ketchup, so used as fries, but nutritious. So the idea was to take and transport breadfruits from the South Pacific into the Caribbean for the cotton plantations. So Bligh was sent off to collect 1,000 breadfruit trees and take them around the world and bring them back. About a month out of Tahiti, his crew mutinies. Have you ever seen any of the various movies of Mutiny on the Bounty? You, of course, know how this plays out. So Fletcher Christian leads a mutiny. About half of the crew sides with the captain, get put into a small longboat, pushed over the side of the ship, expected to die in the ocean. Miraculously, or more correctly, due to Bligh, while Bligh was a bit of a jerk, he was actually an excellent navigator, learned from Captain Cook, and he actually managed to navigate over about 3,000 miles of open ocean and got almost all of the people in the longboat to safety. The mutineers turn the Bounty back for Tahiti. They get to Tahiti, burn the Bounty to the ground, or actually to the waterline, really, let the remains sink. Why did they want to go back? Well, a couple of reasons. The Tahitians were remarkably open about sex compared to Europeans at the time, so many of the men were leaving behind girlfriends or just ready access to sex, and having the prospect of being on a small ship with no women around for the next 2 years was not that appealing. Second, most of the water on board the ship was going to water the plants, not going into letting the sailors drink, so they weren't too happy about that either. But the sex probably was a big thing there. Anyhow, we've got about 50 Europeans that are in Tahiti. They move on to various other islands. Some of them get recaptured by the British Navy that come out looking for the mutineers after Bligh makes it to civilization. But a small group, three men, seven women, three Europeans, seven women, and a couple of Tahitian men, head off to a small island called Pitcairn Island. On Pitcairn Island, within a few years, the Europeans managed, the men reduce themselves, only one, two of them kill each other off. They get into fights pretty quickly. Now, if you ever get a chance to go to Polynesia, you will notice that most Polynesians have dark hair and brown eyes. If you find a Polynesian that has dark hair and blue eyes, odds are they come from Pitcairn Island. There was a founder effect. Pitcairn Island remained remarkably isolated for about 85, 90 years. Tahitians knew where it was, but there wasn't a lot on the island worth going to. Had no actual naval or military value, no trade value, so Europeans pretty much just bypassed it. After about 30 years, the one remaining mutineer was found there, but at that point he was given a pardon and nothing was really done. There was no point going. But consequently, this one European with blue eyes spread the blue-eyed allele throughout the entire population, its children and children and children. People didn't immigrate to Pitcairn Island. Even today, there's about, there's less than 300 people on it, on the island, many of which have blue eyes. So it's a founder effect. Okay? I mean, blue eyes, generally recessive, but you put enough of those genes into a small gene pool, the alleles for that gene into a small gene pool, and it can become predominant. All right, so genetic drift. Again, not natural selection, not sexual selection. There's no particular value or probably detriment with respect to being in Pitcairn, having blue eyes as opposed to brown. So it is evolution in the sense that it's a change in the frequency of the genes in the population, but it's not due to either natural or sexual selection. There are a variety of other factors. Disease. I mean, you can be a stunningly well-adapted individual to your environment, and some new disease comes through and just kills you dead. Right? I mean, you take a look at what happened in North America. Smallpox. You had stunningly well-adaptive indigenous peoples to the North American and South American, for that matter, environment. Suddenly Europeans come in, bring smallpox in, and dead. Estimates suggest that maybe up to 9/10 of the population of North and South America died by disease. They simply had no immunity to these diseases. Not all of them died. Variation in the population with respect to the immune system, but a lot did. Climate change. Again, doesn't matter how great your genes are, you're going to have a hard time coping with global climate changes. Volcanism, right? I mean, again, I don't care how well adapted you are, you're not living in lava. Unfortunately for Slave Lake, if you've been following the news, you're not living in a raging forest fire. So there are things that you just fairly random, you just can't cope with. Asteroid impacts, right? I mean, no one sort of evolves, yep, asteroid impact's probably going to hit. We should start evolving towards that, you know, let's get ready for it. No, it doesn't work that way. You happen to have a population of species that just happens to be under the primary crash zone for the asteroid. Goodbye to that population. Could have been brilliantly adapted. Entire thing could be wiped out. So random events. Human intervention on the environment, on species. I mean, this is going to, you know, we've been screwing around with this for a long time. So very generally speaking here, large-scale sudden changes that are occurring too rapidly for natural sexual selection to cope with, by which I mean allow them to select for across multiple generations those individuals that can be better adapted. These are the other factors, okay? They have an evolutionary effect. Whatever happens to be left will repopulate. I mean, even whenever we get hit with the next asteroid, it's not going to be the end of life on Earth. Just probably the end of our life on Earth as a species, but something else is likely to come back. History shows us this, or paleontology at least shows us this. After all of the other giant evolutionary extinctions that have occurred, something comes back. Usually has to start from, you know, invertebrates again. But looking at it this way, similarly, no matter what we do as humans in terms of, say, global warming, we're not going to destroy the Earth. Well, we might destroy most of the current life on the Earth, but hey, something, given long enough, will eventually re-evolve. Evolutionary biologists have a very weird sense about man-made disasters. If you start thinking in these kind of long time scales, a lot of stuff really doesn't bother you very much anymore. It's like, something will come back. All right. I've said here already, that evolution operates on the level of the individual. An individual reproduces, an individual doesn't reproduce, an individual gets killed by something random, like a Buick, or doesn't. Right? If we had selection at the level of the group, though, let's just consider this. What level should we look for here? Should we consider the species? Evolution acts on an entire species, perhaps? Population, so a subset of the species. A particular community or tribe within a population. What level? If you go back, if you read back into the early 20th century, right, actually even up until really the 1960s, I came out of a zoology background, a pretty good zoology instructor. I still had some zoology instructors in the mid-1980s that still essentially taught group selection because they'd been trained sort of before the shift came in here. Part of what made group selection appealing to many biologists was that it seemed to explain the issue of altruism. Altruism is where an individual sacrifices his or her fitness to benefit another. So gives up resources. Now, by this, we don't mean just gives up a little bit of resources. We mean gives up a significant amount of resources, something that is actually crucial. So giving somebody a couple of bucks, you know, if they're begging for coins, that's not, from a sort of social, cultural perspective, sure, that's altruism. From a biological perspective, it's not. Right? Unless you are currently that far away from starvation, this is your last couple of dollars that you were going to buy food with that you needed to survive, giving it away, biologically speaking, it's not a significant loss in terms of your resources. Okay, so, but many times we do see real sacrifices, you know, sacrificing fitness. So for many biologists, this is very hard to explain from an evolutionary perspective. Why would this evolve? And the easiest explanation seemed to be, well, altruism evolves because individuals sacrifice for the good of the group. Why does a soldier go off to war, fight, put his or her life at stake, get killed perhaps? Well, because it benefits the group back home. Why does someone run into a burning building to try to save people? Benefits the other people. Why will honeybees try to sting individual or organisms, bears, people, chimpanzees that are trying to get into the nest when stinging will lead to the individual honeybee's death? Because it benefits the hive, it benefits the entire colony. Right? So it seems to work very nicely. And this came to be called greater goodism. Individuals will sacrifice themselves for the greater good of the community, the population, the bee colony, the nation, the whatever. Okay? So this is called greater goodism.